You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Friday, restrictions around the country are gradually easing and business owners are eager to welcome customers again. We'll have the latest. And a voice from the front line of one of the worst affected areas in this crisis. New York alone has had 28,000 deaths. We'll speak to a doctor treating children with COVID-19.
It has been difficult in a lot of ways, both on the personal side, because I am a New Yorker and have been for essentially my whole life, and my city is changed in some ways that I fear will be permanent.
So a week into the gradual easing of coronavirus restrictions, how's it all going? That's the main question on the agenda at today's National Cabinet meeting, as well as that important issue of how the nation's mental health is holding up. Joining me with the latest is political reporter Tom Eagledon, now in Canberra. Afternoon, Tom. Can we start with that mental health issue? What's National Cabinet decided?
Well, Thomas, there's a new $41 million program to help boost mental health services, particularly for the vulnerable people most at risk during this crisis. That, of course, is in the bush and out of metropolitan areas, young people, and obviously those who are supporting families potentially without an income coming in throughout this this difficult time, Tom. Now, there's an interesting question here, because modelling overseas is showing that really things like suicide rates are not going up as some have projected, including some modelling out here earlier in the week, Tom, that was projecting a really big and really serious increase in suicide rates because of those factors we just spoke about. That Japanese data is showing that, in fact, suicide rates there are actually gone down during this coronavirus period. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, though, says that's not a cause for complacency. He's talking about how telemedicine's been a really big help here so far since this virus got started in terms of people's mental health. Here's a little of what he had to say.
We are now seeing the number of presentations and consultations occurring for mental health now back to levels that were being experienced pre-pandemic. Half of those being done through the telehealth mechanism. So that is welcome. It's an important reminder to all Australians. Of course, keep COVID safe, but don't neglect your other health conditions.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. Tom Eagledon's with me. Now, Tom, there was also a briefing from health officials this afternoon. What's the latest there?
Well, look, Thomas, it was frankly a pretty delighted Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, who reported that there are now just 50 people nationwide in hospital with coronavirus. Just 12 of them are in intensive care. They are as good a numbers as you could expect. The concern remains, however, that there is the potential for a second wave. And indeed, we saw perhaps a hint of a potential for that, at least in some figures out from some of the states today, Tom. Victoria, for example, has 20 new cases overnight. A lot of that was expected. Six of them or more revolve around the McDonald's at Fawkner there in Melbourne. Another one came through Cedar Meats, for example. So officials were keeping an eye on those outbreaks, as it were. The real concern, though, is perhaps in Queensland, in the city of Rockhampton, where just one new case has emerged, but it's in an aged care home, and that was not at all expected. Also, Tom, just a very brief update from medical officials about the potential for Kawasaki disease linked to coronavirus to infect children. The chief medical officer has no concerns about that here in Australia.
As we've been hearing as well throughout this crisis, of course, I mean, this is an economic emergency too. What's on the agenda there?
Well, there were updates from the Reserve Bank Governor, from the Treasury Secretary, and interestingly also from the Prudential Regulation Authority, suggesting that perhaps the National Cabinet is taking a bit of a pulse check of things like the insurance industry and the banking and finance industry. We did see those really quite disturbing numbers earlier this week on the economic front, a predicted 10% decline in GDP, unemployment, as we know, jumped to 6.3%, not as bad as some had been predicting, but the Prime Minister says that is going to get worse. That number will definitely get worse. And he also says, Tom, that after the briefing today, that he's going to stick to the parameters for the JobKeeper and JobSeeker payments, costing some $20 billion a month to the budget. But he is resisting calls from his backbench to rein those in early at this stage.
Okay, Tom Eagledon reporting there from Canberra. Thank you. There's some news in sport as well this afternoon, and the AFL has announced it'll resume the season on the 11th of June, with training starting up again on Monday. Now, teams will be allowed to do full contact training from the 25th of May. Speaking in Melbourne a short time ago, AFL CEO Gillon McLachlan says it's a significant step for the league.
I feel confident that how we start is not how we will finish. The AFL will implement protocols over and above the government restrictions to protect the health and safety of every member of our industry and the wider community. These have been developed with the advice of the federal, state and territory governments, along with the relevant chief health officers, as well as the AFL's own medical team, and with consultation with players, coaches and clubs.
Gillon McLachlan, the CEO of the AFL. Well, as we just heard from Tom Eagledon there, Australia's paediatric experts were asked to look into a mysterious illness reported in children overseas this week and whether it might be linked to COVID-19. We heard about the cases in New York City. They've also been reported in the UK and Italy. So far, there are none in Australia. And as Tom just said, the chief medical officer says it wasn't a concern for him. But what can we learn from the situation in New York? Let's head there now. Dr. Adam Ratner is the Director of Paediatric Infectious Diseases at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at New York University.
It certainly appears from the data that we have so far, and that includes kids who've been seen in New York City and reports from Europe as well. It seems that there is a link between COVID-19 and this new syndrome. But in the situation that we have now in New York City, which with such widespread infection with COVID-19, it can sometimes be difficult to tease out what is due to that infection and what is not.
So what is Kawasaki syndrome, and why do some doctors suspect the conditions in some children might be linked to the novel coronavirus?
Right. So Kawasaki syndrome is an inflammatory disorder that we see in children and only very, very rarely in teenagers or in adults. And one of the reasons that it's called a syndrome is that really what it is a collection of clinical findings. These children have red eyes and a rash and swollen hands and feet and things like that. What we don't know about Kawasaki syndrome, despite it having been described decades ago, is what causes it. And over the years, there have been many theories about what might cause Kawasaki syndrome, but we still don't have a definitive answer to that.
So it does seem to be the case that a lot of children have mild conditions. Many might be asymptomatic. Do we know why some children might be more vulnerable?
Right. So with Kawasaki disease, even prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the thought was that some children might be either genetically predisposed to go on to develop Kawasaki syndrome, or there may be something in particular about either the strain of virus that they were exposed to or the dose of virus that they were exposed to. But I think that most people think that there's a genetic element to this. That may or may not be true with the syndrome that we're seeing now, because one of the most important things that we have to figure out is whether this new syndrome is indeed Kawasaki or just something that looks like it.
And these cases we're seeing are rare at the moment. We're hearing there are no confirmed cases in Australia, but I guess broadly, does it show that we still have a lot to learn about how the virus can affect children and adults?
Without a doubt. I mean, I think that probably the number one question that I've been asked over the past week or so since we've started seeing these cases is, why are we seeing them now? And I think that the answer is that most people think of COVID-19 as something that affects adults and doesn't affect children. And we're lucky in that children have been spared for the most part the brunt of this pandemic. But lots and lots of children have been infected by the SARS coronavirus that causes COVID-19. And I think what we're seeing now, especially in New York City, where we have a large population that was, you know, largely infected around the same time, we're now seeing some of those rarer cases, those rarer downstream effects that can happen after COVID-19, even in children.
You're in New York City. We've been hearing about that part of the world, obviously, for a long time now. Some alarming numbers of cases there when it comes to coronavirus. You've been looking after children. Can I ask you a personal question? What's it been like for you?
It has been difficult in a lot of ways, both on the personal side, because I am a New Yorker and have been for essentially my whole life, and my city is changed in some ways that I fear will be permanent.
Yeah.
And it has been challenging as a doctor, where many of us have been called on to do things that aren't what we usually do day to day. I mostly take care of children. Many of my colleagues have been called to take care of adult patients with COVID-19, just because the sheer volume of those patients has been so much greater than on the pediatric side. And then we have also had to take care of the rare children who have gone on to get very sick from COVID-19. It has been an experience like nothing else I've ever seen, and it's still going on. The early weeks were terrifying in that, you know, we saw cases, you could literally feel the number of cases growing each day. When you went to the hospital, it was busier and busier, and that has slowed down, thank goodness. But we're still living with this every day here.
Is there a sense of optimism at the moment?
There is. I think we are all relieved that the curve has flattened, that the number of cases and the pace of the cases has decreased over time. And I think that some of the most extreme changes in our hospital and in other hospitals, the turning units that were not intensive care units into intensive care units, and the housing of adult patients in pediatric wards, many of those things are starting to go away. The city itself still feels highly abnormal. All of our stores are still closed, and people are sheltering in place, and it is a very different world than it was.
Can I ask you about that, Dr. Ratner? Because here in Australia, Social restrictions are easing. Children are returning to class. What do you think we need to keep in mind to protect children and the community?
The advice that I've given here, I think, applies elsewhere as well, which is that I agree with many of the people who say we have to, you know, while we've done a good job of flattening the curve and of slowing the pace of infections, we have to figure out how to go back to, you know, as close to our normal lives as we can. But some of easing the restrictions is understanding that it's not a one-way thing, meaning that if you ease the restrictions and there's an acceleration of cases, you have to build into your thinking about this the ability to slow down, the ability to maybe go back into some of the restrictions, which I fear would be very difficult for people and very demoralizing. And I hope that you guys don't have to do that. And I certainly hope that we don't have to do that.
Indeed. Dr. Adam Ratner, thanks very much for speaking to The World Today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Adam Ratner, the Director of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at New York University. The grim reality of Australia's surging unemployment. We've been hearing about that a lot this week, and there are growing concerns that some businesses simply won't be able to survive without that JobKeeper support when it ends in September. But some economists are proposing a HECS-like scheme to bridge the gap. The ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, has been looking at the scheme. Afternoon, Peter. There's talk of a cliff in late September when JobKeeper ends. Now, how could this scheme potentially change the situation?
Well, good afternoon, Tom. With a jobless rate of 6.2% and rising, and also given that a V-shaped recovery or a rapid economic recovery seems very unlikely, economists from the Australian National University and the University of New South Wales say a smooth transition from JobKeeper is now more critical than ever to getting businesses back on their feet. Now, anyone with university fees understand the HECS scheme where fees are repaid once people are working. So these researchers say a government-controlled scheme similar to HECS should be extended to businesses. That would be $500 in cash and $1,000 in a loan paid back at very low interest rates once the revenue starts flowing back. That would be less risk for the government and the taxpayer, but a very big leg up for business. ANU Professor Bruce Chapman is known as the father of the HECS scheme, and he told me that averting the cliff is make or break for many businesses, especially in building more certainty with the COVID-19 shock set to run for months.
It would be important to have some kind of continuing financial assistance to companies that require it, but it's important not to keep on inflicting damage to future budgets. So a revenue contingent loan, which means that the business would only have to repay the government when it's doing well in the future, a little bit like the HECS system, except based on revenue, to recover just about all of this money within a few years.
How important is this going to be, given that there's going to be something of a cliff when JobKeeper payments end at the end of September?
You know, if the cliff just is there and companies could drop over it, and who knows how many there might be, this could be extremely important. We don't know what's going to happen, but to withdraw it without any transition at all is going to be problematic for them.
If you're a business out there at the moment and thinking, well, how am I going to survive if I don't get things back up and running? This is clearly something that they would have to consider.
Well, you'd hope so. You'd hope that the government's got in mind some kind of process of transition. And of course, one way to ensure that economies are in trouble is to have more uncertainty, even though it's very hard to imagine you can have more uncertainty than now.
Australian National University Professor Bruce Chapman there with Peter Ryan. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app. This is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. You can find all of our stories on the show's website. Just search for The World Today. You can also subscribe to our podcast. And on that note, the ABC has a new podcast which answers your biggest questions about the coronavirus. It's called CoronaCast. And once again, you can find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a question for the podcast, you can go to abc.net.au/coronavirus. The World Health Organization warned this week that COVID-19 may actually never go away. So as social restrictions ease, what can scientists tell us about how the virus moves through the population? Already, genetic information about COVID-19 is being added to a global database to help scientists understand how it spreads. And in Australia, Professor Ben Howden is one of the experts contributing to it. He's the director of the Microbiological Diagnostics Unit at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne, and we spoke earlier. Professor Howden, in layman's terms, what is genome sequencing and how's it being used to track the spread of COVID-19?
Yeah, genome sequencing is really unpicking the whole genetic code of a pathogen. So that's working out every bit of genetic code that forms the basis of that pathogen. And then what you can do is look at any subtle changes in that genetic code and compare them between samples and look at how that helps track how pathogens are spreading. And this includes with the SARS-CoV-2 genome.
This might make you cringe, but I'm not a scientist. So is it genome sort of like a barcode, so to speak, of this virus in many ways?
It is. It's a barcode. So every pathogen has a barcode of sequences. In the SARS-CoV-2 genome, there's about 30,000 pieces to that barcode. And so each time one of them changes, and that's what happens with evolution, pathogens slowly change over time. And each time one of those barcodes out of those 30,000 changes, you can map that and use that information to put the puzzle together of how this is spreading.
So with that in mind, and with the knowledge that a lot of this information is being put into a global database at the moment, how accurately are you able to pinpoint where the virus has been using this sort of information?
Yeah, I think the accuracy of that increases over time as more mutations occur and as we gather data on increasing numbers of sequences and also information on where they're arising from. And we can now, you know, quite accurately cluster genomes together so that we can look at a set of genomes and say these all match quite nicely together based on the genetic mutations that we've found in the sequence. And then we're finding that they do map very closely to what is expected from the epidemiology. That, you know, when I talk about epidemiology, it might be where they've traveled from or where the outbreak is thought to have occurred. And so we are seeing very good concordance between those two things. And we can now start to accurately predict where a new infection might have come from based on the data that's available publicly.
Are you talking about that at a global scale, or are we getting a clearer picture of the situation in Australia in terms of where the virus came from and the path that it took to get here?
Yeah, I think that, well, it's both things. You can actually go from the micro scale to the macro scale. So we can look within a particular institution. So this data could be very useful for healthcare workers and possible hospital outbreaks, but it can also be useful at a global scale to say, okay, this infection seems to have traveled from this country to this country, and you will therefore have a better sense of how new importations might be coming into your country and whether it's multiple importations or whether it's a single importation, then ongoing spread. And that information is critically important to continuing to address the outbreak.
We've obviously been covering this for months now, and, you know, we hear a lot about mild or completely asymptomatic cases. What does genome sequencing tell us about the extent to which some people might be carrying the virus undetected?
It's a really good question. I think we're still learning about that, but there's definitely opportunities to use the sequence data not just to cluster cases together, but to understand how the pathogen is spreading. And using some sort of genomic model, and we can start to look at how many cases might have been missed in the data set, for example. You know, and that's still early in its evolution in this outbreak. But I think there will be a time when we can start to model the genomic data and look to infer how much it's spreading in the population using the pathogen genome data, and also possibly getting a sense of how many cases might have been missed in the population. So at this stage, we wouldn't say that's highly accurate, but definitely that's something that could be used in future.
Is it fair enough to say that there are limitations with this sort of information, though? I mean, I imagine it might be difficult for scientists to work out exactly where a mutation of the virus might have happened.
So the mutations, yes, we can't say exactly where they occurred. There are a point in time when we sample from a clinical sample and we sequence that virus, so we can't say where that mutation occurred, with either in a location or necessarily in time. But what we can do is use that information on the mutations to generate clusters of like viruses that give us a lot of information about which ones are spreading in which populations, and that's how we use that mutation information.
Okay, Professor Ben Howden, thanks very much for speaking to The World Today.
No, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Professor Ben Howden from the Doherty Institute in Melbourne. Well, as restrictions continue to ease, people in New South Wales, the worst affected state, are today taking a step back to normality. Gavin Coote's been out for a look today. So you've been getting a feel for things this morning. How's it playing out in the cafes and restaurants today?
Yeah, we've taken a very significant step, Tom. Up to 10 people can now dine inside pubs, clubs, restaurants and cafes. This is the first time in about 2 months. So a lot of people eager, but I wouldn't say they're doing a roaring trade at this point where I've been. Of course, it is early days, but some people I've had a chat with around Sydney pointed out it's not the most inviting weather today.
No.
there is still a bit of apprehension as well for some. But that said, there is a real sense of optimism for some cafe owners. Sandeep Manam is one of them. He's been setting up his alfresco dining space in the hope that people will start flowing in again.
It's been very hot times for our previous weeks, but we're hoping everything's going to be back in soon, and we're expecting everything getting better as soon as possible.
How quickly do you expect business to pick back up here?
We're trying as much as we can, like changing the menus, and we're always taking feedback from the customers, and we're trying to organize whatever they want.
How do you think it will be managing numbers as it builds up?
That is a real challenge too, and then we're planning to keep a bookings, like pre-bookings, or like we're just trying to give takeaways if we are really busy in dining.
Yeah, you must miss it a bit, having your customers hang about for a bit and relax.
Yeah, that's true. We miss a lot of our customers. Like, it's been like a long time. We miss our customers. And we're hoping back everyone coming back to the offices and coming back to our shops like soon.
Sydney cafe owner Sundeep Madam speaking there with Gavin Coote. As you might have heard on the show, we've been hearing from musicians around the country. They're offering their take on the World Today's closing theme. There's been some really impressive results, some rock, some jazz, even bagpipes. And you can find videos of the musos in action on Twitter. Just follow me at Thomas O'Reety. Today, here's something completely different. We thought you might want to ease into the weekend. So no big beats, no loud guitars. We're going to go with a Hawaiian flavour today. This one's from Nick Reinberger. He's a musician, a poet, comedian, a presenter of ABC Illawarra's morning show in New South Wales. And we think this remix sums up his versatility pretty nicely. Have a look on Twitter. The video will surely get you into a weekend mood. Have a good one, wherever you might be. Thanks for your company this week. Hope you can join me at the same time on Monday. Stay safe.
I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
In some ways, it's weird to compare education to coal or iron ore, but that's how economists think about it. And it's a huge export earner. It brings in $38 billion a year. Or at least it used to.
Today on The Signal, COVID-19 has already devastated the education sector, but the worst is yet to come. So will all of our unis survive? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.